feet. He's hacking and whacking and smacking.
Hey, Dennis.
Hey, how are you, Alex?
I'm good. I have my friend Sam with me here, and also Michael. We also have, Jordan D. White on the phone as well.
Hey, Jordan, how are you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Good, good.
And Mike has now joined as well. Thank you all for coming together, gentlemen. Brought us all here to find out how we can kill Superman.
Okay.
No, this is a podcast, actually.
Yes.
And this is our 20th episode, and thank you both for agreeing to come on. It's fantastic. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Jordan.
So, no problem.
So let's start asking questions. We're not going to talk about that one big thing, but there is one other big thing that I'll get to talk about. The Marvel bromance. What happened?
Yes. Like, inquiring minds want to know.
What are we talking – which bromance are we talking about?
There was actually a collection that was going to be released in about a week or two called Marvel Bromance, but they changed the name.
To Marvel Superhero Team Up.
Okay. Was it really going to be called Bromance?
Yeah.
Swear to God.
There was actually a picture on the cover that was going to be Spidey and Wolverine doing a fist pound.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can see. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
I'm looking at it on the internet here. This is actually the first I've heard of this, and I don't know whether to be more uncomfortable that there was going to be a bromance issue or that they canceled it and called it something else.
Yeah,
they're both disturbing developments, Frank.
Well, I'm pretty sure I remember seeing in an interview somewhere that Joe Quesada said that it was. They just thought it was something that was going to get dated too quickly.
But
the idea that the name bromance would be looked down on as some dumb thing from back when, in just like a year or two or something like that.
All right.
Okay.
Our murderous.
Anyway, so
he's.
Yeah. All right. So now onto some more. Now onto some other hard hitting questions.
Okay.
So.
Threw me for a loop with that one.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I know
you
you're
like to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, so
that's good.
I actually have in here with me in my hands X-Men Noir, which I picked up yesterday in a rush after finding out that you were willing to be a guest, and finished reading it, and I loved it. Actually, I was a fan of it.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you very much.
And I know that you're particularly inspired by old actually film noir, right?
Absolutely. We me and Fred have talked at length about being inspired by films like The Third Man. and the Maltese Falcon, et cetera, et cetera. So absolutely.
Now you, your art has been really defined by the fact that you're clearly not afraid to shadow it.
No.
is there like, is there something in particular besides obviously old something that I guess encouraged you specifically that amount of black?
Sure. I mean, it's, the amount of black isn't really an issue to me as much as the mood. In other words, I'm not going out to, you know, in order to empty out my inkwell. It's not, that's not the point. The artists that I've always enjoyed the most have been people who have used shadow to evoke mood, and that goes from comic book artists like Steranko and Al Williamson to Caravaggio, an Italian painter. So it's and Ribera, a Spanish painter. I've always been drawn to. I mean, the whole point of naturalist art is you're trying to create the illusion of objects being lit by light. So the idea, and not that there's anything wrong with it. Going back to bromance, not that there's but the idea of sort of defining form with just line. You know, regardless of how the light mm-hmm. falls, has always seemed to me to be a very strange method of thinking, and I've just never been able to think that way.
And it definitely shows in your like kind of your definition of faces, where it's like there's not many lines. Like it's more lines from like kind of from the way the face is formed, or from
right, exactly.
And I think that's kind of interesting. Like, I know you do a lot of this on computer, actually, right?
Yeah, I ink and color on the computer almost exclusively. It goes a little bit back and forth these days. I might actually pencil on paper, ink some elements, scan it in, do some stuff on the computer, print it out, do some more stuff by hand. So at this point, the computer has become such an integrated part, not to say integral part, but to say an integrated part of the process. That it's hard. Sometimes I looking back, I think that something was done on the computer is actually done by hand, and vice versa. And I know, for example, that it's funny because I was actually talking with Mitchell Breitweiser, who's another
fantastic.
Yeah, and he's actually been penciling on the computer with a Wacom tablet, printing it out, and then inking by hand, which is almost the exact opposite of what I do. And
really
neither of us can understand what the other one does. Like I can't understand drawing on a Wacom tablet. It just seems alien to me. And the inking is such a time consuming and laborious exercise in precision that to me the computer seems really well suited to that portion of the job, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But for Mitch, he loves just sort of being able to draw and be free to get rid of things and draw in layers in the computer. And then once he's happy with the structure he's got, as far as I understand it, the way he works, he loves to print it out and play with it on paper. So it's, you know, I think it's really getting to the point where, you know, when I was a kid and that was it called the Batman computer graphic novel. It was
Digital Justice. Yeah,
Digital Justice.
Ah! Oh man, I read that when I was like
yes.
seven.
It's fun.
Yes.
Fun stuff. It's like, oh, it's a computer graphic.
Yeah.
In the
end, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. In the end, now production, lettering, coloring is all done on a computer. Stuff is scanned. Even if you do stuff by hand, it's still scanned and touched up on the computer to better prepare it for printing. So to me, the way that I look at it, the final product is the comic book, not the art. And I
of
think
course,
that
yeah.
actually, sort of for me, having the computer being an integrated part of the process, it sort of reminds me that it's the final effect that matters. Now, if I was doing art, you know, which I am working on stuff for gallery work, that's all by hand because that's that's about the presentation that you're seeing the art in person. So it's, to me, it's almost like the difference between live performance and performance that's going to go on a CD. I mean, I'm much more comfortable with, if I was a musician, I would probably be much more comfortable doing all kinds of effects and production and really polishing it up and letting the computer do what the computer does best. And for a live performance, it would be more about an organic sort of experience. So that's just the way that I look at it.
Jordan, has that helped actually? Like, as an assistant editor, Jordan has like kind of now a lot of this movement towards kind of having work on the computer, like helped out with your job as an assistant editor?
Well, it's interesting. You said, I mean, whether or not how they depend, I mean, speak with words, regardless of how they prepare it, for the most part, we interact with it only on a computer. People actually, it's funny, people always ask me, you know, oh, can we do tours of the Marvel offices? And a lot of times I say, like, you know,
like I have.
It's really not,
yeah.
Well, you have to, that's right, you have. It's really not that interesting anymore. It used to be that there were artists there drawing stuff, and there was all this comic art, and there was all this stuff going on, and it's like, yeah, but now everybody's at their house, and they send it in as an electronic file over the internet, and, you know, we don't have these giant stacks of comic boards like we used to in the old days. So whether or not, like Dennis was saying, if Mitch is drawing it one way, and then, I mean, it's, by the time it gets to us, it's going to be a digital file anyway.
Right.
For the most part. So, regardless of whether they use paper or not at all. I'm sure that there are some artists we work with who don't use any paper drawing at all. They just make it on a computer and send it on in.
Malov often works that way. But there's no paper involved in any part of the process.
Mike, do you want to ask a question? I know you've been very quiet this whole time.
No, I was sorry. I like listening.
Oh.
Basically, anything I was going to ask, you kind of just said anyway. So it's kind of like you're reading my mind and then just saying it for me. So
that's what I do. I like that's how I roll with the reading of the minds.
So Jordan, I mean, like, kind of the word assistant editor, I feel like it doesn't really describe, like, kind of, it's hard to kind of describe what you do. Like, could you actually tell us sort of like, on a typical day, what do you get to do?
Sure. Although I guess the first thing I should point out is that with my two master's degrees in English, I can tell you that assistant editor is two words.
Oh, sorry.
It's not a problem.
But
basically, an assistant editor, you know, gosh, what do we do? On a typical day, first of all day long, I'm probably on my computer doing email almost the entire day. Things are coming into me, scripts are coming in, pages are coming in, inks, pencils, colors, and, you know, take a look at them, make sure everything is cool on them. They're probably going to be great depending on, you know, who's working on them. They're going to be good stuff. Dennis is sending me pages all the time. They look great. I send them back, hey, they look awesome. But, you know, Wolverine doesn't have a giant wing coming out of his forehead, so can you take that off? Random things like that. Right? Remember that, Dennis, when you drew him with wings coming out of his forehead?
Sure, whatever.
It
works out.
And I mean, obviously,
I'm sorry, Jordan. Yes, I do. I remember when I did that incredibly inexplicable thing, which I would never do.
Exactly. Artists are sensible, so they know what they're doing. So for the most part, we're all good. We just keep an eye on things, make sure everything's running smoothly, and you know, make sure that it gets there when it needs to get there. That's about it. I don't know. And we get to
I could point out from my experience, even in the relatively short time that I've been in the business, what assistant editors have done have changed. I mean, it's an assistant editor used to be really someone that was just sort of liaison with the artist and trafficked art, made sure that this got there, that this was FedEx there, and everyone has what they're supposed to have, and people are turning in stuff and meeting their deadlines. And assistant editors now are much more apt to have creative control of a book. The assistant part coming in when, you know, basically they're still checking in with the master editor, so to speak, about what they're doing. But you can correct me if I'm wrong, Jordan. My perception is that assistant editors these days are given a lot more autonomy. And I don't know what that – why that change came about, but it's certainly what's happening now, it seems.
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty good assessment. I don't know exactly why either, but yeah, the longer that we are at Marvel as an assistant, and when I started, it was just that sort of thing, but mostly just trafficking. But as you're there longer, they, you know, the editors that you work with trust you more. They say, you know, obviously you know what's going on. You know kind of books that, you know, that we're looking to make and the kind of things to look for in a book. And so as I've been there almost 2 years now, there are certain books that I am listed as the editor on. My official title at Marvel is still assistant editor, but I am the editor of the Ender's Game books and the Ender's Shadow books.
Right.
And
great books.
A couple other things. Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and also there was another thing that you're now pretty well known for, and it's called The Age of the Century.
Yes.
Oh, am I well known for that? That's awesome.
Well, I mean, like that was basically, I know you said you were like, you know, you're usually just all you do is spend time, like, you know, kind of doing, sending emails, but I mean, you managed to find, kind of find the time to sort of, this was sort of something, your idea, right? I mean, it wasn't
It was. That was a series that was my idea. I don't know. I the thing is, I love it more than anything in the world. Not literally, but very close.
So, you love your wife more.
Yes, I do love my wife more, my cats, but Age of Century's up there.
I love my cats more than Century as well.
Well, there you are. The problem, of course, being that it's not something that I should probably shout too much from the roofs because I don't think too very many people bought it.
No.
That shouldn't be my one claim to fame, hopefully. But yeah, I love it so much. I think the whole series was so great. Jeff Parker and Paul Tobin wrote it. And
both great writers.
They're both great writers, and they both got exactly what we were trying to do with that series, and they made it so much fun to read. And all the artists that worked on it, there was like four or five different artists that worked on the short stories throughout it. It was so good. It just was so much fun. And I think the trade is out there. I think it is an amazing trade. It is so much fun to read.
And
you guys read it, right?
Because you both, yeah, I've read it. And and I was, I think it's interesting because you kind of both have these, I'm holding both these graphic novels up in my, like, in my hands right now. Well, Sam is holding Age of Century. But these are both sort of focused at certain times. These are both sort of period comics, as you like, kind of, but written now, kind of looking back. And I think it's interesting that you both have worked in these kind of times.
Do you guys think that there is a burgeoning nostalgia market in comics these days?
I think nostalgia is always been part of at least the comics market now is primarily about nostalgia, and it's often something that's actually difficult. I know what you mean when you say nostalgia. When I think when I think of the nostalgia market specifically in comics, I think of something generally negative, and that's because I think of people who are coming to comics to sort of read them and get a sort of reflected glow of their childhood rather than coming to the books to have a somewhat of a new and unique experience, I should say. And I think that's an albatross that's sort of difficult to carry.
Yeah, I mean, you've sort of become, like, after being the X-Men Noir was the first Noir series to come out, right?
Right.
Yeah.
X-Men Noir and Spider-Man Noir came out at the same time.
All right, but then, like, after that, we've had now multiple noir, like, series based around superheroes,
right,
including Luke Cage and Punisher. And I know you've been the kind of the go to guy for the covers for those now.
Well, it's just been it wasn't so much as a go to guy as much as that it was just a decision made early in the process that the ad images that we were doing for the X-Men Noir series seemed to become regardless of immaterial of the quality of the covers. I'm not going to sit here and say it's because they're so fantastic.
Oh, I like them though. I mean,
but no, I mean,
we will sit here and say that it's because of they're fantastic.
You can do that.
We will.
Thank you. But I think it's just that they became recognizable sort of calling cards for the series, and someone at Marvel decided that's what the sort of type of imagery they wanted the whole series to be centered around, just in terms of just a quick identifiable marker for people to go, oh yeah, I remember that. That must be like this, or Daredevil Noir must be like X-Men Noir. That's like this, and
Marvel Apes.
Yeah, I don't think we're gonna be doing that. The second time around, I think that we're much more comfortable. First of all, I'm way overworked. And
can you tell us about what are the things you are working on as well? I mean,
well, I'm actually writing an online comic that I think I can talk about. Jordan will yell at me if I'm not supposed to.
Yeah, Jordan, you want to?
Yeah, pretty sure you announced it already. So
yeah, I think so. Weapon X Noir, which is going to be drawn. Now, I don't know if we can talk about who's drawing it. Can we do that, Jordan?
I think you Twittered it the other day, didn't you?
I remember when I heard, first heard about it. This was still under discussion, the drawer. So.
We CP Smith, who is terrific, who drew the fantastic Wolverine Noir Mini, will be drawing a four-part online comic, four eight-page parts, centering around what is Weapon X Noir. I can tell you Weapon X Noir is not Wolverine, but Weapon X Noir rather is something, and what it is and what it has to do with an upcoming world war is the question of the series, we're going to be looking at Nightcrawler and another character that we're bringing back. It's sort of a semi-prequel to what's going to be happening in X-Men Noir 2, although not directly.
The Mark of Cain, right?
I was going to – yeah, X-Men Noir, Mark of Cain. Fred actually hates it when I call it X-Men Noir 2. So it's X-Men Noir, Cain, and we are looking into – I was actually going to draw – all 32 pages, but it just became impossible. So my editor was like, well, what would you think if maybe we got I was like, someone else to draw it? Fantastic. Let's get someone great. And funnily enough, my script is riddled with notes like, a crowd of people of various different ages and different economic classes. Giant crowd. Good luck with that. You know, thank God I don't have to draw up this. It's just constant notes. I hope it doesn't irritate CP too much, but I'm glad I'm not drawing it. I write much more complex than Fred does. So there you go.
That sounds fascinating.
I'm always telling Fred, don't. That's too hard. Draw. And meanwhile, I'm like, 50,000 people chase this guy, and I want to see every guy. Face. Enjoy.
See, that's neat, because that creates a little bit of another link between the X-Men Noir book and the Wolverine Noir book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even on the creative side, that's kind of cool.
And I know there are certain details that are different between the X-Men Noir and Wolverine Noir, right? Like, was it the...
We started off with the clear idea that we were not trying to make a noir verse. Like, people would ask us at the beginning, people ask me and Fred, like, you know, what universe is this, are these events taking in? And I'm like, an imaginary one that is not
one that exists in a book,
one that we're playing with, that we don't think that way, you know, and that's fine if people do, but we were deliberately, and I think that when the edict went out to start creating these other titles, it was with the idea. I mean, I think we had in our head some rules about how this would work. And we said no powers. I think either Fred and I, or I decided that Supernatural was okay, because my idea basically was that anything that was okay in a 1930s pulp magazine was cool. So you had crime, you had pulp action heroes.
So you have this this angel character that kind of disappears and reappears very easily.
Well, he's an actual Marvel timely character, and I mean, to really go back to it, the impetus of the noir line was, you know, what if Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, who were both at Timely in the late 30s, decided to create the X-Men at that time, as opposed to when they met later in the 60s, and what would they be? What would they be like? And so we kept the original personalities, you know, for the most part intact, and just got rid of the superpowers. Excuse me, that's my dog playing in the background.
Okay, I thought you had a parrot, actually.
That's sorry. A dog? I'm sorry. But...
That's my dog playing with his squeaky toy. Which
Okay. I'm so relieved you have noticed.
It's very difficult to discourage him. Desi, knock that off. Thank you. Oh, that was pretty easy. And further beyond that, to me, my personal thing is that I think magic is okay, supernatural is okay, especially dark. Dark supernatural is fine, but no powers. Nothing that you wouldn't have typically seen in a 1930s pulp. People have different opinions on that. But to go back to – in a roundabout way, to go back to answer your question, we thought, look, we're not trying to make a quote-unquote cohesive universe. We're not trying to get bogged down in continuity. The Wolverine in Wolverine Noir can be completely different than the guy that we have in X-Men Noir. And although I think there's some tangential things that are linked, for the most part, it's different. And Spider-Man – look, I've met people right off the bat who are like, I love X-Men Noir. I hated Spider-Man Noir. I love them both. I love Spider-Man Noirs. X-Men Noir was crap. You know, it's like, look, it's all different. There's something in there. Punisher Noir, Frank's Thierry's Punisher Noir is very different from Wolverine, very different from Daredevil, very different from Luke Cage has a flavor completely all its own. And I think that's all terrific. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't like one, you know, there's probably another one that you'll enjoy better.
Just like normal noir books or noir films.
Exactly.
They vary from film to film, and some of them are wildly different. Personally, I think the ones I prefer, I like the post-war noir stuff after World War II more than I like the pre-war stuff. That's just me.
There you
some
go.
People definitely prefer the earlier stuff.
So I'm kind of gonna go to the opposite end of the interview spectrum here.
Okay.
So Jordan, we asked Mr. Dennis Calera here what he's got coming up. What have you got coming up?
Yeah,
what are your
I actually have something coming up with Jordan, which is two issues of Wolverine First Class, which I worked on with
that's
Jordan.
True. Oh, nice.
Which
I
are completely different. Bright and happy.
That's the next issue. It should be out sometime this month, I think, right? Or sometime next month.
Sometime very soon, because I know that I'm doing 20, and that's got to be done, like, the color has to be done, like, this week. So.
Oh, you're doing 20!
19 and 20.
Both. So, Wolverine First Class 19, because 18 is already out, so 19 should be out soon.
Okay.
Definitely already went to the printer, so.
Okay. So.
In addition, you know, like I said, I'm still doing all the Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow series, which I really enjoy. I'm working on a lot of the Hulk books. Incredible Hulk is a book I assist on. Hercules as well is a book I assist on.
Yeah, big fan of Hercules, stuff. As you know.
Yeah, I love it too. You know, it's just they do such a great job. That's another book with Mr. Fred Valenti. That one co-writing with Greg Pak.
And is Greg writing Hulk by himself?
Greg's writing Incredible Hulk by himself.
Incredible Hulk.
However,
Jeff Loeb is working on Hulk.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, Jeff Loeb is doing Hulk. However, Fred Van Lente is writing the backups for Incredible Hulk. 10 pages per issue featuring the all-new Savage She-Hulk.
Yeah.
Hulk's
character.
Daughter from the future. Yes,
she's
yes.
Savage.
Well, did you read issue 601, sir?
Not yet. I haven't got a chance to. I'm excited.
Oh.
I got to go pick it up.
Yeah, be careful. Stay away from spoilers.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
I'm curious
what else?
And, how long have you actually been at Marvel now, Jordan?
Almost 2 years.
So, that's pretty, right. What has it been like, your kind of experience working at Marvel? And, how long have you been working as an artist for Marvel, Dennis, as well?
I'll let Jordan answer first.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's terrific. You know, I love comics. I spend so much time reading comics every day. But I love it. You know, I definitely don't feel like I just spent 8 hours a day or more, usually more, working on comics. I don't want to look at them anymore. No, I come home and I still want to read them because I adore them. So working at Marvel it's great. Once in a while, I get you get frustrated. Like it's like any job, working with people, you get frustrated about this and that, and get frustrated about the other thing. But every once in a while, I have to just sit back and go, wait a minute. I'm helping comics come out. Like, this is the coolest thing in the world.
That is pretty badass.
You ever feel that way, Dennis?
I'm sorry, what was that, Jordan?
You ever feel that way, where you're just like, I'm working on comics, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's like any job. I mean, drawing is obviously a very, you know, physically laborious thing. And
right.
drawing comics, I mean, I've been working on a series of drawings for an exhibition, and it's a lot easier than comics. I gotta tell you, because comics, you're doing, you know, a page a day. It's anywhere from 3 to 7, 8 panels, and you're doing backgrounds and foregrounds and foliage and clothing and muscle, and it could be a very physically laborious job. And then you remind yourself every once in a while, like, "Hey, man, I'm drawing Wolverine, man. Fucking A." Awesome.
I'm definitely a big fan of your foregrounds. I gotta say,
Thank you.
Backgrounds actually. I love your cityscapes. I mean, it's an odd thing to sort of like actually notice that much, but I like love your buildings. Do you actually like you use references like when you're doing a...
Oh, absolutely. I studied architecture for years, so I was in college. I studied architecture 4 years towards a 5-year degree before I decided to switch over to illustration. I really, really gave it a shot, and I enjoyed it. I still enjoy architecture, and I'm just one of those guys that just can't like fake buildings. I can't like just draw a couple of lines and here's some windows and a fake sort of, you know, cantilever and then.
And that's, and there's a triangle on the top for the,
right,
for the
roof. And a little, you know, water tower. God bless you if you can, but if that's you. But when I was drawing New York, I wanted it to be New York. And also, specifically X-Men Noir, I wanted it to have a very documentarian feel. Like, I didn't want it to feel like if I just drew New York in a sort of made-up three-point perspective, I mean – look, you've seen that a million times in comics, yeah. And you'll see it a million times more, and it's cool, and it's fine. But that, to me, said modern comics in a way, in a voice that I didn't want. And the voice that I wanted to remind you of these beautiful old black and white photographs that we've all seen of old New York and Chicago and post-war Europe. And I wanted that voice to sing. So – It was a lot of reference, and playing with it and adjusting it and making it palatable for a, sort of a visual presentation. But to go back to actually your earlier question, I've been drawing a Marvel this time around. It's just past 2 years. I was drawing X Factor for a year, then I moved over to DC for another year, and then I've been back at Marvel for a little bit of an extended period.
What have you done? What did you do at DC?
I did a Legion of Superheroes for 5 issues, and I did various odds and ends. I did a really cool issue with Tony Bedard of who I also worked on with Legion of Superheroes. I did an issue of JSA Classified.
Yes,
I believe it was number 25.
Yeah, there are individual prints up on your website that I saw.
Yes,
before I
yes.
did this.
With the very cool Golden Age Green Lantern, who's one of my favorite characters.
Golden Age Green Lantern busting down a fucking wall and just kind of judging the readers.
It's good stuff. Issue of Hawk Girl written by incredibly Walt Simonson. And I got to draw that for Walt, and he gave me the cover that he drew for that issue as well. It's actually hanging behind me right now.
Wow.
So that was super cool. And issue of JSA Classified and several different things. And I moved over to Marvel to work with Fred mainly.
Yeah. Also, I have a question because I was doing Google search just to find out anything else I could just, you know, see what else you had done. And your name, picked up on Amazon for like D&D books.
Sure, absolutely. I did a lot of gaming stuff early in my career. D&D, a lot of
collectible
card game stuff like Legend of the Five Rings. Big shout out to my Legend of the Five Ring fans. Those people are crazy.
Oh,
awesome! They never forget you. Legends of the Five, like it's like magic, but it's like an Asian food bent and Asian magic.
I remember when that was all going on.
Yeah, Legends of the Five Ring fans are like Legion of Superhero fans. They're like they're comic book fans. They're role-playing game fans, but they're separate and apart. They're just Legion fans are Legion fans. Like, they really love Legion of Superheroes, and they're passionate about it. And Legends of the Five Rings fans are very, very passionate about that game, and they never let you forget it. They're very supportive, and they're terrific.
Actually, that bleeds into something I wanted to ask you. Looking through your bibliography, and you've done, like you said, you did Legends of the Five Rings stuff. You've done some Magic the Gathering original series, I believe.
Yes, yeah. Back in the old days, mm-hmm. deep dark '90s, Acclaim Comics was doing Acclaim, formerly Valiant Comics, was doing Magic the Gathering comics, and I got to do some sequences, some painted sequences, actually. In the middle of some of those books, as well as I did
awesome.
Sliders. Yeah, I did Sliders covers for them, and I got to actually draw an issue of Sliders. Which
I love Sliders, the TV show. What a good show!
My issue was awful. I mean,
I'm sorry.
Full books, and it was terrible. But the star of Sliders, Jerry O'Connell, actually wrote the script, and I did my best. So I can't, I'm not too ashamed of it, but because I did what I could at the time with what I had. Yeah, so a lot of various book covers. I did a cover for NASA for a CD of, you know, music inspired by space by various different modern composers, and I got to meet Buzz Aldrin and just very, you know, being illustrated.
That is so cool. Yeah.
I was like, "You've been on the moon." I didn't say it, but I thought, I was like, "Oh my god, this guy's been on the moon. This is a moon hand." It's moon hands. Awesome.
And actually, I wanted to know the working on properties like in comic books, like Magic the Gathering or like Sliders. Is that, I know it must be, it's very different for a writer working on that. Is it a different experience doing art from a book like that as opposed to doing something that you make up from whole cloth like X-Men Noir, right, or something like that?
Are you trying to avoid the uncanny valley, or do you?
It's a different kind of a challenge. I'm currently doing for Boom. I'm doing Farscape covers, and I've done some Star Trek stuff for IDW, and it's definitely a different kind of challenge.
Do you feel yourself like you're beholden to a certain look for characters?
Well, the way that I would put it is that licensed properties, the thing to remember is that you're not, for better or for worse, and if it's not your thing, then don't do it. But for better or for worse, your stuff isn't the star of, and it's true to a certain extent when you work on the X-Men. I mean, the star of the X-Men is Wolverine. It's not your – if you're lucky enough –
it's Wolverine and friends.
Right. Wolverine and the rest of the gang. If you're lucky enough to be one of those guys like Neil Adams and Batman, or who gets identified with a particular character, and your artwork almost becomes like part and parcel of that character. Like if you ask a guy of a certain age, you know, Batman, they're thinking of Neil Adams. You know, or if you ask a guy a certain age of Elektra, you're thinking of Bill Sienkiewicz or Frank Miller or whatever, what have you. But in licensed properties, it's even more extreme. I mean, really, you're hired to represent, not represent, but to represent, whether it's Star Trek or Farscape, an experience that's sort of packaged and licensed and pre disposed to a certain effect, and that's what you're doing with your art. And to vary too far, I mean, like we've tried to get certain kinds of covers through I won't say which licensed property, and I've been lucky. Everyone that I've worked with in terms of licensed stuff has been very, very kind, but you know, sometimes the answer just is, you know, that's just not a whatever. I'm just throwing it out there as an example. That's not a Farscape image, or that's not a Star Trek, you know, mm-hmm. kind of image, and that's not what we're selling. You know, we're selling widgets. We're not selling widgets. This is not that's the game. And
so this is no widget factory.
There's no widget factory, not for Star Trek. So if you like Star Trek, if you like Farscape, and you're having fun working on it, that's great. And if it's not, then you walk away. That's all.
So kind of to retool the question for you, Jordan, is there a bigger pressure, or are there more eyes looking at you when you're brought onto a more high-profile comic over at Marvel?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's one of the things about the range of the books. When you're looking at a top-tier book that sells the most, like, you know, Hulk or Incredible Hulk or something like that, you know, yeah, there's a lot more attention paid to it by everybody at every step of the way, you know. More focus on it, you know, more pressure to keep it good and high quality, of course. Whereas sometimes with the lower selling books, you can, you know, you have a little bit more freedom and more opportunity to kind of just do something totally crazy and out there, and hopefully something that will pay off artistically. You know, I mean, I would say that Incredible Hercules, one of my favorite books in the world, we probably wouldn't be able to get away with some of the crazy stuff we did if all eyes were on us at all times. You know?
Which ironically sometimes means that when all eyes are on – not all the time, but sometimes it means that when all eyes are on that book, all of a sudden you can't – you have to stop doing some of the unique and kind of wacky things that may have made the book popular in the first place.
Is there a way that you can go to the people who are, I don't know who your particular higher-ups are, but whoever the higher-ups are, can you go to them and say, look, this is how it is? This is how our book has gotten to be the way it is, and it needs to continue?
You could do that and get fired sometimes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think they do understand that for the most part. I mean, again, a book like Hercules, if Hercules tomorrow started outselling Hulk, they wouldn't say, all right, good, now make it like Hulk. They'd say, well, what did you do that all of a sudden made you start selling? And they would. If they saw, well, it's that you're doing these kind of, like, you know, interesting, fun, off-kilter stories, then they would say, great, keep doing that. I mean, unfortunately, Hercules is not going to start out selling Hulk tomorrow. The book does a certain amount of business, and people love it, and I love it, and we're very happy with it, so that's cool.
So, also, what are we reading now, like, this week as well? Like, what did you guys pick up? Like, I know there's a lot of comics coming out now that's kind of, that are big deals. I know, you know, Blackest Night is in DC, and we all have certain things.
Strangely, I mean, completely coincidentally, I've been reading a lot of Hulk. Like, I wasn't actually reading it up until, like, a month ago, and then... Because I didn't know quite what to make of the whole Red Hulk thing or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm actually a dope fan. And I picked it up, and I've been enjoying that. I've also been rereading a lot of old Hellboy stuff. And,
yes.
And I never read it when it was out. I kind of ran through in the last couple of months Why the Last Man, the entire series, and
In trades,
and the entire run of so far, anyway, of Walking Dead, which I never picked up.
Both of those are a blast.
Did you get the omnibus of The Walking Dead or
the big compendium?
No, actually, Walking Dead I actually borrowed from a friend, but I probably will buy the omnibus at some point.
Yeah, those are great too.
And a bunch of creepy and the creepy and eerie hardcovers from Dark Horse actually too.
So
that's cool. Most of my time I spend reading. Just like almost every book that comes out.
Yeah.
Jordan's readers are
mostly going to bed and reading a couple books beforehand.
Yeah, almost always. I mean, I read almost all the books that Marvel puts out. I read a good number of the books that DC puts out. So the problem is when I do buy trades, they end up sitting there for an awfully long time. The trades that I've been trying to keep up with are, there's a pair of manga that are coming out right now that I just love. One is Pluto, and the other is 20th Century Boys. They are both so good.
Oh, is that still coming? A friend of mine keeps niggling at me to go out and 20th Century Boys starting yesterday.
He niggles at you?
Oh, yeah, yes. He'll send me messages out of the blue and says, oh, you've been reading that 20th Century Boys yet? And I have to tell him no, because I haven't.
I'm sure it turns
really
out.
All right. Well, now that I have the great Jordan D. White.
Feel approval.
Yes.
It's the same creator who did Monster, which I don't know if you guys have heard of. Also terrific, but that's over now, so I'm not reading that anymore. But also another series that I've been enjoying is not a manga. It's a webcomic, but I've only been reading it as it comes out in trades, is Dr. McNinja.
Oh hell yes, I love Dr. McNinja. Great stuff.
It's just been so funny. I actually picked it up because Chris Sims on the Invincible Superblog recommended it.
Who also gave you a quote
personally
on the back of the Age of the Century as well.
No, that's exactly true. That's the thing is that I got into Chris's blog because he was reviewing books that I worked on and seemed to like them. And I was like, awesome, this guy is cool. And he obviously really, really got Age of the Century in a way that some people did not. So I was very pleased with that. And so when he recommends things, I'm like, oh, this guy seems to get it in the same way that I like things. So let me check it out.
He likes things. I like things.
So you guys obviously are checking what people are saying online. And I think that's an interesting kind of position to put yourselves in to sort of see the immediate reaction from fans after your work is put out. Do you have any stories about kind of what that is like?
I have kind of an R-rated story, if that's
it. Oh, go ahead. R-rated is even better.
We keep it NC-17 around here, sir.
The funniest thing that I've ever seen online about me in particular, I guess hosted with Alexa Mendez on the Marvel In This Week podcast. They do a video. Marvel does a sort of a I forget what it's called. Weekly Watcher. That's what it is. Yeah. Marvel does the Weekly Watcher every week with Alexa Mendez, and I was helping her out and helping her host. She was very kind to invite me. And the YouTube comments, of course, are all either it's very funny that internet comments generally are either extremely, extremely positive or voraciously, vitriolically negative. I mean, just like, God, you really hate this, whatever it is that you hear. So one person
we have a segment like that. What's that called, Sam?
Sam bitches about stuff.
Yeah.
No, really? Okay, there you go. So because look, no one's ever run into a bar and said, "Hey guys, there's two people out there not fighting. Let's go outside." That's what it's about. But one person said, "X-Men Noir sucked balls," right? Mm-hmm. And then someone commenting on his comment said, "Wow, Dennis Calero is really pretty. I hope he sucks balls too." Thank you. I was like, that is simultaneously the worst and most horrible and most amazing thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
That's fantastic. It's a compliment, really, obviously.
Oh, no, of course it is. Well, not the X-Men Noir sucking balls part. That's not
– Well, that, no, that part, no.
That part's not nice.
But somewhere that
well, maybe that person meant because it's so beautiful too.
That's probably what he meant, I'm sure. That's probably what it was. That's my favorite story.
The thing about the internet stuff, it is pretty funny. What gets me, though, is that people writing mean things on the internet, upset things on the internet, is one thing. But it always really shocks me when someone takes the time to write us a really, really negative letter. Because I'm like, wow, like you took a lot of time out of your life to like specifically make sure that I know that you think I am terrible.
Have you personally received the...
I mean, usually they don't say the assistant editor on this book is an idiot. No, usually they're talking about the book in general and just everyone involved in working on it. But still, the sentiment is there.
And then how they should all be fired.
Oh.
Everyone's become an expert in who should be fired.
Yes.
You must be a really amazing CEO. Because
there are a lot of angry HR directors out there.
Apparently, that guy should be fired. Oh, that's horrible. That way that...
I'm making a memo.
Very strange.
Learn how to fire people.
I had a very vitriolic and sarcastic letter about the design of Wolfsbane in X-Factor, which I couldn't even really take fully. I'm not casting aspersions, but I really couldn't. I mean, just realistically, I couldn't take responsibility for that because I was going from Ryan Sook's all his designs for his characters. There had been a decision when I took the book over that was going to stay the same. We were trying to sort of keep the boat going in a sort of even keel. But boy, this person really did not like it and was really sarcastic. And I'm just like, it was probably a waste of time. But I wrote him back and I was just like, listen, man, you got to realize you're yelling at an actual flesh and blood human being about a character that doesn't exist. Doesn't exist.
A werewolf. A mutant werewolf.
He's a mutant werewolf
who
does not exist.
Down.
And you're yelling at me, and you're being very hurtful. I'm very hurt, and I'm a real human being. And he wrote back the longest, most like just apologetic.
Oh.
I didn't expect to get anything back, and he was just like, you know, I thought about it, and you're just so right, and I really apologize, and I don't know what came over me. It's just really wrong, but I really hate that design. So what's up with that? Like he actually. Which is fine. Which the point was, it's fine to not like something. There's a lot of things that I don't like, and that's fine. But I think it's the not realizing that these aren't products that come out of a machine,
right?
Sort of just all intact by magic, which you can.
They haven't sprung full blown.
Right, they come from people trying really hard And that should always be, you know, somewhat kept in mind when you're one is criticizing. And again, not to say that that should be a reason not to criticize something if you don't like it, you know. Criticism is very valid. I look at all the criticism of my work online, all the commentary. Every once in a while, there's something to glean in terms of what seems to be working, what's not working. I actually learned specifically, I have one example. I learned a really great lesson when I was drawing Legion. There was a panel real quick with three guys, and one guy was sort of making a shitty comment at somebody, and the other guy was sort of making a snarky face at him behind his back. But because the guy making the face was on the left part of the panel and the guy commenting was on the right side of the panel, a lot of people didn't get the connection of what was going on. So even in my mind, even though I'm like, well, it's one panel, so it's one moment, really, because you're reading from left to right, in a real storytelling way, his reaction came before the thing the guy was saying that he was reacting to. And even though at first I read that, I'll be honest, first I read that, I was like, well, that's genius and you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. After a while, I was like, well, listen, I obviously something's wrong here. What is it? And I learned a valuable lesson. I mean, that's not to say that, but most of the criticism that you get on the internet, at least that I do, about art, boil down to A, something is not your style. Like, I don't like the kind of stuff you do, which is fine. But if you don't like horror movies, you're not going to enjoy The Shining. It's and it's not to say that if you don't enjoy horror movies, that everyone should stop making horror movies. That doesn't make sense.
That does not make sense.
It doesn't. But people proceed from that, like, as if to say, "Well, I don't like this." So, or the second most popular criticism is basically, and I hate to pull a John Byrne, but it's basically sort of like it's about what you would have done differently. I don't think that character should go in that direction. They should go in this other direction. Well, you know, when you can get to write the book, you can do that, and I'll criticize what you do, or I'll say maybe you were right. But that in and of itself is not it's not a helpful criticism.
Right.
And
it's not a professional form of criticism. It's more like saying, well, I don't like how he does this. I want him to do that. It's like almost childish.
And that's – well, no. I mean, look, it's valid. If you're not getting what you want, you shouldn't buy it. I mean, that's – you know, you didn't get your money's worth. And no one can argue with that because it's all really subjective. But in terms of, you know, what it really means to criticize something, which is not, you know, in a positive way to point out taking stuff for what it is, you know, what the intention is, and then measuring the success against that intention – That could be very positive. And if someone says, look, I don't think that hand was drawn very well, and if 10 out of 15 people say that, it would behoove me as someone who is trying to make a living entertaining people to look at that and go, you know, maybe there's something to that and I should really watch for that in the future. And the great thing about comics is that next month you get a chance to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
And make all new book edit mistakes.
And also, I gotta say, also, like, it's really interesting because something that I didn't bring up yet, but the lettering in X-Men Noir is something that I think was very interesting. I know you don't do lettering or anything, but I guess.
Well, I can say real quickly that more than any other book I've ever worked on, X-Men Noir was really a group effort, and I expect X-Men Noir 2 is shaping up to be the same thing. Nate, the editor,
Nate Cosby,
and Fred had carte blanche to talk about the art in terms of what we should do. We talked about the script, talked about the story. We between the four of us, you know, Nathan's a busy guy, so Nathan to a lesser extent, but we all really had free rein and carte blanche to talk about the book as a package. And I think that's one of the reasons why, at least in my mind, the book came out as good as it did. And that included the lettering too. And you know, we got a chance to look at lettering samples, which how often does that really happen? You know, we got to look at samples from different letterers to see, you know, who we think would be the best fit. And his was by far, you know, the most had the most personality.
Yeah, and you don't see that kind of character, like a lettering in most comics.
Right.
It's sort of something that's missing in a lot of comics. It's usually just sort of the same kind of font and.
But what do you mean by that? Enough of my talking. What do you?
Yeah, well, I'm misinterpreting you too, Alex. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean it's usually like I feel like in comics nowadays. I mean there is sort of a there are a lot of them coming out, of course, but some of the times it's usually just kind of your general word balloons that are perfectly round, and then
right.
They have just sort of your regular kind of comic book font text.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it depends on what you're reading, though. Like, if you're reading like some most mainstream comics, like something you'll see. I feel like you'll find those there. But like, I can just say out of the blue, I guess the Sandman. Every different character has a different kind of font. Like you have one girl who's like all mixed fonts and different sizes and colors, and then you have the Sandman who's just like Venom. You know, black bubble, white deranged letters. You know, it's unique.
You just
like
compared Sandman to Venom. That's great. Yeah, they're pretty much identical, you know.
Yeah, except, you know, one's more eloquent with his text and the other one just wants to eat people.
And the other one isn't Venom, right? It's, you know, I mean, but every era, look, I mean, every era of comics, I mean, I've been reading comics since I was a kid. And I've been reading comics since the early, mid-70s and through the 80s, through the 90s, and I guess the aughts, the O's. And every era has sort of a general house style. And I've always eschewed that, and allow me to use the word eschew. I've always thank you. You're welcome. because my favorite books, like I loved West Coast Adventures in the 80s. I loved
Squirrel Girl.
I love Fantastic Four. But my favorite books in that era were Meltdown by Kent Williams and Muth and Moonshadow and stuff that was just off the beaten track. And stuff that was more about a guy saying, you know, whether it's Frank Miller or Bill Sienkiewicz or one of those guys saying that, you know, I want to put my own spin on this. And X-Men Noir was sort of our effort to do something similar, which was in a way, which is why it was fun, Jordan, to work on Wolverine First Class, which was the opposite. It was the opportunity to do something fun, bright. Totally within the main and almost like ultra mainstream, because we're almost like going back to sort of an 80s feel, which is sort of like my take was sort of my take on it was sort of that was the loose basis of the title, that, you know, this was sort of harking, you know, the old costumes, the old situations, getting to draw Kitty Pryde as a 13 year old again, and that was a lot of fun. If you told me you wanted me to draw, if someone told me they wanted me to draw Wolverine in a mainstream book for 6 months, I don't know if that's where my strength were to lie. But as an exercise, as something to do every once in a while, it was certainly a lot of fun. You know, it sometimes it's fun to wear the straight jacket, and sometimes it's fun not to. Both can be interesting experiences. You know, to work within different disciplines.
And couple more questions, because obviously we can't put this. You guys got to do your things as well. So
I'm drawing as we speak, so that's all good.
Oh, really?
No, nice,
fantastic.
I'm inking the Luke Cage Noir 4 cover.
Oh, very good then.
Which, by the way, Luke Cage Noir 4 is drawn by the very talented Sean Martinborough, one of my favorite artists. So
actually, yeah, I was going to ask you that. What are some of your favorite artists out there right now? And Jordan, what are some of your favorite writers
or favorite editors?
Yeah.
And I think Jordan probably editor? Counted on both.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Please, you first, Dennis.
Okay. Although, Jordan, I would like to hear what your favorite artists and writers. My favorite artist working now, probably Jay Lee. I think Jay is a guy that has really carved out a niche for himself to do, you know, stuff that is just – it's him. Like, it's just nobody else but him. You know, when he does his stuff, and he's constantly an inspiration. The way that he works with black, the way he works with line and feathering, it's beautiful to behold. Alex Ross, Brian Hitch.
We actually just reviewed this episode that you guys we've been interviewing for. Is actually we're talking about Kingdom Come.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's really one of my favorite books. Like, really.
I'm glad you like it too. Sam's not a fan.
I have.
What was your problem? More the art or more the story?
It was generally more the story. I can appreciate art wise. I only have a problem with Alex Ross's art in large, and I start to see this the very strange qualities. It's just that realistic and so careful.
The point of off-putting, almost.
Yeah, it's
with cod pieces and all.
But then he gets back and does a gigantic splash panel of Captain Marvel looking down on Superman and saying, "Hey, I'm gonna rape you, boy."
I don't remember the rape scene.
Narrowly voted down from the
final. Okay.
Sam fell asleep watching Pulp Fiction and holding Kingdom Come.
But
I might be a little confusing, but yeah.
No, but I love Alex's stuff, and
I'm a fan as well. It's
Mignola, of course. John Paul Leon doesn't get to do enough stuff, and so that's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of guys whose stuff I really like. No, artists, we're very bitchy, and a lot of us.
Yeah, do you want to bitch as well? Because I know it's sort of awkward to always ask, but I mean,
well, no, I mean a lot of us will say, "Oh, I don't like that guy. I don't like the way he does this, and I don't like the way he does that." Like you'll go to an artist, you'll go, "Oh, do you like, Alex Ross? Oh, his heads are too blocky. Or do you like Brian Hitch? Oh, his stuff's too photographic. Or do you like this guy? His stuff isn't photographic enough." You know, what it comes down to really is that any artist, I think, that is making an effort to do really good work. I mean, an artist that's not just hacking it out, but someone who's really making a day-to-day effort to do the best work he can do and to speak with his own voice, you know, so to speak, is going to be someone who has very specific ideas about illustration that he's implementing in his own work. So in other words, to make it more new agey, we're all walking on our own individual path. So of course, when someone else is doing something and he's solving problems, you know, visual problems in a different way, the instinct may be that, "Oh, that guy's got it wrong. That guy's approaching it the wrong way." And you have to kind of hit yourself and remind yourself, no, he's approaching it his own way. And we're all allowed to like or dislike, have our favorites and are not our favorites. But, I think that's where the real bitchiness comes from. And as far as writing, I'm enjoying the books that I said that I was talking about. I enjoy Frank Miller's stuff quite a bit. I enjoy Mignola's Hellboy stuff. I like Jim Kruger's work, the stuff he's been doing at Dynamite. There's quite a few guys. I like, I know how it's going to sound, but I like Fred Van Lente. His stuff, I know how it's going to sound, but I was reading, I read, I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hopefully will hear my voice and somehow, ironically, will be encouraged to buy the trade, which is available for $13 on Amazon.com. But I was reading the script for issue 3. I like that, Jordan. I was reading the script for issue 3 of X-Men Noir on a plane on the way back from a convention. I forget which one. But a certain scene in it caused me to decry. Like, holy shit. Like, I really did not expect it. And I've never reacted that viscerally to a script before. No insult to anyone else that I've ever worked with. And Fred is able to do that kind of a thing often in his work, is what I would say. So there you go.
Yeah. And so, Jordan, what about you?
Well, my favorite artist, my favorite comic is Savage Dragon. So I always have to say Eric Larson.
There you go.
Writer and artist.
I think he's terrific.
I love him, man. I can't help it. It's my favorite book for sure. But I really like
love,
Alan
love
Davis.
That you can't help the purest love.
Yeah,
it really is. You don't love anything as much as you like. I know that movie is crap. I know it's awful, but I love it. And I did not say that.
I'm not saying that
Eric Larson is crap. I'm just saying, look, you know, you love it, and that's the purest love.
To defend it to anyone else.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Exactly. That's what I meant.
But I really like Alan Davis as an artist. I think he's a great artist. Amanda Connor, I love
Power Girl.
Adam Warren is one of my favorites as well. But he's a writer. He writes his stuff as well.
What does Adam Warren write?
He does Empowered right now.
Okay, cool.
Empowered?
Yeah.
He used to do he used to do Dirty Pair series for a while, which was terrific. He also writes Galacta, of course.
Galactica.
Which was from the Marvel Assistant Side Spectacular, who's going to be getting her own.
That was a fantastic two issues. I gotta say, I love seeing you in a Galactus costume.
Well, I will not be in the online Galactus stuff, but Galactus will. So
that's good to know. So it's gonna be an online thing, actually? I thought it was gonna be an actual miniseries.
No, not a miniseries. It's gonna be an online thing, and then it's gonna be collected into a one shot. So it's gonna be really cool.
Nice.
But as far as writers go, that's something. I really love all of Garth Ennis' stuff. Typically speaking, some of it is incredibly thick, some of it is incredibly funny, but it's usually always very good. Another person who writes and draws their own stuff is David Lapham.
Young Liars. I finally read Silverfish, actually.
Yeah, Silverfish was great. Young Liars was terrific. Another person is James Kachulka. He writes and draws his own stuff.
Yeah,
totally
sure.
Insane. Nothing to do with superheroes, but it's wonderful. Yes, American Elf.
American Elf. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
That was one of the most interesting autobiographies.
Well, the only thing I love it. The only thing I don't like about American Elf is that before he did American Elf, he used to do once in a while do comics called Magic Boy, which were the same elf character of himself, but the comics themselves were much more. They were more strange. It's like they were autobiographical until, like, he would start to fly and go to Mars. You know what I mean? Like, they'd be about him, like, going, oh, I hate working at this Chinese food restaurant. It sucks. I'm going to take the day off. Oh, look, I found a magic ring. Let me go on a quest. And it would be like, what? And that doesn't ever happen in his diary books, unfortunately.
Never happens in real life. I got a couple more to add if you guys don't.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think everyone should really visit Marvel.com. There's some really great exclusive stuff on there. A lot of it is free at any given time. But Spider-Girl, I love Ron Frenz's drawing. It's just I have a soft spot in my heart for that stuff. And a writer who I wanted to mention because I really love his writing, even though he's really well known for his drawing. But Dave Gibbons is a really amazing writer. He did if you want to look back, he actually did an issue of Aliens, an Alien special that Mike Mignola drew back in the late, either probably in the early 90s. That's just
idea.
a fantastic read. And of course Mignola drawing Aliens, you can't go wrong with that. And he also wrote, speaking of Silverfish, which is one of my favorite graphic novels, Dave Gibbons also wrote a book for the same line called I'm zoning out. You're gonna have to figure out what it is.
Are you also? Is there anyone you want to bitch about? Because you did promise that.
No, I'm not gonna bitch about it.
Okay, no, all right. Well,
I gotta work with these people.
Yeah, I know you gotta work with them, obviously.
I'm happy. I would just theoretically, I would be very happy to write for an artist whose stuff may not be up my particular alley, but is stuff is effective, and I have no problem. With that, that's, you know, my I'm trying not to be limited to my own, you know, likes and dislikes.
Of course. This is a Courtney. This is something that you're not gonna. I don't want you to actually respond to at all because I promise you wouldn't have to and shouldn't. But because with the merger between Disney buying out Marvel, we're thinking of positive things that will come of this, that could come of this, and one of the things I did like sort of hypothesize is possibility of, you know, perhaps Disney taking on some Marvel artist talent, do some work for that kind of something for Disney. And this is a question for you, Dennis. Like, is there something, if you could, like, instead of what Marvel hero would you like to draw for, what Disney franchise would you like to draw for if you could? Would you like to work on a Steamboat Billy?
I have a cheat answer to that. First of all, the graphic novel I was talking about is called The Originals, which is owned out.
Oh, yes.
But it's terrific. Dave Gibbons wrote and drew it, and it's I highly recommend it. But to answer your question, I have a cheater answer, and that answer is Tarzan, because Disney, I think, currently owns the rights to Tarzan. I wouldn't draw it like the Disney Tarzan, which was a great movie, but I mean, I would like to take it back.
But you're an artist, and you know, honestly, you have your own artistic talent. Yeah. It's not like it's a
I would want to do the Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan. I mean, to to take your question more in the spirit in which it was meant, I'm going to say that I would love to draw Sleeping Beauty. I think that's my favorite. It's my favorite nice. Disney movie. I love the villain. I think she's hot. And she was totally wronged, and I would have a different ending where she kills everybody. They didn't invite her to the party. That's not right. She had it, you know. She was right to be upset. That's BS is what that is.
Yeah.
Should have invited her. That ain't cool.
Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, God, that's such a blow-off.
Someone had a block party in my house, did the same thing. I'd be like, what?
Party foul, motherfucker.
You are. Your kid is so cursed. Oh, God. I cursed the shit out of your kid. I would do. Thank you.
So get on that, Jordan.
I could, hey, you know what? I could answer that, kind of.
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, I just didn't want...
Like, I could say what... Had... I mean, if we're just talking hypothetically, what book based on a Disney property would I want to edit? That's easy. I would pick Nightmare Before Christmas. I think that was...
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. That would be interesting, actually.
Now, well, here's the question, though. Do you... ongoing series or...
miniseries.
Or miniseries just based on...
Oh, no. Well, I wouldn't want it to be based on the movie. I mean, there's already a movie. It's mm-hmm. fine. Good the way it is. It would have to be, like, going forward.
The world itself is so rich with material.
Right. So, I mean, ongoing series, why not? As long as people are interested enough to keep buying it, that would be fun.
But Tim Burton's name on anything.
I like a lot of Disney movies, so I think it would be fun to do comic fun. Like a Rescuers comic or a Great Mouse Detective comic. There's some cool ones in there that you could do some neat stuff.
I have no idea how many copies I would buy of a
Rescuers. Rescuers?
Really?
Oh, my God.
That's the one with Zsa Zsa Gabor, right?
Well, in a comic, you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be a selling point to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, feel free to. You can put her voice into any comic. You know, that's who the voice of the woman in Age of the Century is, Wendy Lee. Zsa Zsa Gabor.
In your mind, it is.
I actually have a question for Jordan, if I may.
Sure, go ahead.
You may.
This is even better.
Has there been any indication that Marvel, because Disney has their own line of comics that are coming out now, is there any indication that they're going to turn that over, or they might turn that over at some point in the future to Marvel to handle for them?
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah,
I don't know anything about that.
That hasn't been talked about. Okay.
Yeah. It's sort of awkward
about the beginning of this sort of merger. Where it's like, you know, you obviously you don't know much, and you're not. Don't know.
Right.
No one knows really what Disney's going to do with it. So
I think everyone is kind of hoping that it ends up being somewhat like the Warner Brothers takeover of the buyout of DC, which is generally speaking, you know, develop our properties, keep certain tentpole properties healthy, like Batman and Superman. In Marvel's case, it'd probably be like, you know, Hulk, X-Men, Spider-Man. And other than that, you know, feel creatively free to lose money, which is always a wonderful position to be in. It's Marvel and DC, they're in a lot of ways they're different entities. The classic explanation is that DC is quote unquote more corporate. That's a little, from my point of view, it's a little less true these days in terms of Marvel, you know, quote unquote not being corporate. But there's definitely sort of different approaches that each company takes, and sometimes those approaches flip flop. Sometimes one company on one side of the street is more sort of from the head down. Decisions are made of how books are going to be done, and you're kind of just following lock and step, filling in that vision, you know, by the editor in chief or somebody up on top. And the other one is more like, you know, everyone's kind of doing their own thing. And then there'll come a time, and strangely enough, I've seen it happen a couple of times. It seems to happen almost at the same time when the attitude flip-flops. And all of a sudden, like, you know, let's say DC was Dan Didio was doing sort of defining how everything was going to run. And you're just filling that in, and Joe's being loosey-goosey. All of a sudden, it's completely the opposite. And it's just, you know. It doesn't make a difference to me as long as I get a paycheck, so I'm fine. I've always managed to kind of do what I kind of wanted to do, which is I think just pure luck and meeting and having the luck to meet with and work with great editors like Jordan, like Nate, and like Mike Martz at DC. So
I think that's just the hope of a lot of people that are big fans of Marvel, is that just because like they will just Marvel will just keep on being allowed to do what they want to do with just sort of the backing of Disney.
Well, the backing could actually make things a lot freer.
Yeah, exactly. That is like something I did hypothesis as well. Bill. Like with the current movies, I mean, coming up soon. I mean, there are certain stars that are needed, kind of like needed to be paid high, like higher prices, and so with Disney behind them, I mean, it shouldn't be that much of a problem. Hopefully.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Paramount and Sony control so much of the sort of tentpole guys for right now. That I think, generally speaking, I think we're not going to really see the real changes for probably for a long time. Would you agree with that, Jordan?
I can't really say too much. I don't. Yeah, I, no. Like I said, it's not because I'm like protecting secrets. It's really more that.
No, but you kind of work for other people that don't, you know, that work for other people.
It's more that like I don't really know the answers, and
I think that means that Jordan knows something. You guys should go.
No, it's not. I don't want to say anything that could be construed as, well, the guy who works at Marvel said this, and it's like,
yeah,
obviously, I don't really know that.
That's
much,
what
you know?
Everything, yeah, that is this. Everything talked about now is should be taken with a whole lot of grains of salt.
Shaker.
Yeah. I think he knows something. I think he's holding out on us.
Marvel knows.
Like they said in all the press releases that, you know, the same thing they said to us. Disney is looking at it the way they looked at Pixar. They don't want to mess up what we've got because they liked what we had. That's why they bought it.
Yeah.
So, you know, again,
nice.
It won't go through until probably later in the year, you know. But once it does, the plan seems to be, from all indications, to let us do our thing.
Yeah, and that's definitely the, like, and that's what I hope too. I mean, I think if that's all, I think there's a lot of like people that are like kind of that are just angry about this that really don't need to be. And now,
yeah.
Mike and Sam, do you guys have any more questions? Because I feel like we've kind of definitely been here for a while, and I think it's time to definitely call it a day after your question.
I have a final question I'd like to end on. So if there's anything you want to ask, please, Mike?
Mike, you there?
Okay.
Okay.
I believe
we lost somebody. Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yes. Go.
I want to know what you guys thought of Age of the Century since we kind of touched on it a lot. But I love it so very much. And I want to know.
I really enjoyed it too, actually, and I think it's interesting, sort of, to have the character of the century after. And I read the Century by Paul Jenkins, and I loved it a lot. I was actually a big fan of the whole idea, and I was a big fan of his appearance in the New Avengers as well. And I think it's sort of this. I enjoy the whole kind of retrofitting of the century and like kind of these older stories. I think it's fantastic. I mean, I know you're a big fan of the camp of kind of certain times back then, and I think that's something I've always enjoyed. And
Superman Showcase Presents Superman is, I can't recommend it enough. Like, it is so off the wall, and I just love it. And that's part of why we did the centuries, because those things are so great.
And even the retrofitting, but I also love the deeper story of what happens in the Age of the Century. It was something that I'm still not even sure what really it all meant. But I just love the fact that you have these moments where it's just like, he's just, like, he's freaking out. And I think it's, like, so well done. And just, so, like, it feels so deep.
I think I understand it pretty well. If you want, I could try to explain it, but it's a little bizarre.
Do you want to explain
it? Well, basically, the idea was that one of the things that freaked people out about the century was the idea that, that he had always been around, and that the Marvel Universe we've been reading about since the 60s is not the real one. The real one is where the century was around, and it got changed at some point. And that really put a lot of people off, because they were like, well, those are the comics that I read. Those are the real ones. You know, what are you trying to say? So one of the things Jeff Parker tried to do with the series was to say, well, no, what happened was the century was this force, this life force from another universe, which we don't name, but we certainly have someone in mind, who was forced out of the universe he was originally from because it was becoming so dark and filled with crises of various kinds, that his essence was forced out of that universe and came into the Marvel universe. And that, however, because his essence was so good and pure, it had to forcibly push itself backwards through time to when the Marvel universe was more innocent and pure, and weave itself into the timeline from the 60s forward. And that's how the Sentry came about. And so because he's not a natural part of the Marvel universe, it keeps trying to, like, push him back out of it, basically.
I think I know who you're talking about.
What did you say?
I think I know who you're talking about. I think that's a super idea.
Why, thank you.
who could they be talking about? That's super, man.
It's Alan Rickman, isn't it? Alan Rickman.
Thank you very much.
So, I mean, I think that was the kind of meta idea that was going on in that series. And I think, he did a nice job. And is it true? Well, as the last issue says, it's just an imaginary story. Who knows? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
Cool.
I always think it's really funny that, I mean, Dennis was talking about earlier about the noir stuff. People ask, what universe does it take place in? You know, they really want to lock everything down as to where it takes place and what interacts with what. And that's cool, you know, that's fine. But I do think it's sort of funny because it's like, to me, that sort of continuity is what developed because there were a bunch of comics, not something that developed first and then we said, well, let's put some comics in it. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There are comics where people just said, I'm just making a comic. It's about this superhero. Does it count? Well, you'll find out in 5 years if anybody references it, and then you'll know it counted.
Right. Or it didn't. Exactly. Right.
So, when we're Age of the Century, yeah, we kind of tiptoed through it, said it was imaginary. Who knows? If it was Reed's theory, is it true? He's the smartest guy on Earth, so maybe.
Yeah. And I know, Sam, you didn't get a chance to read a lot of it, but you did.
No.
What did you, like, of what you read, what did you think of it, actually?
From what I said, it really struck me, the whole book, from what I got to look at, as sort of what Alan Moore was trying to do in 19...
Well, I wouldn't say trying to do. He did a great job. That's a great series.
But he just didn't get the opportunity to finish it.
Right.
But then this has all the camp of the original and the
animal. Is it kind of what Moore was also doing in the Supreme series with all the
absolutely.
Oh, good point.
Okay.
Because
I enjoyed that too.
Yeah, that was a great period.
You know, it's one of the things that is sort of unfortunate. And I'm kind of, you know, it takes a lot of balls to say you agree with Alan Moore, I know. But I do agree with Alan Moore in that he talks about when he did Watchmen and Steve Renetta and all those things, and then all of a sudden after that, and combined with Frank Miller stuff, everything became really dark. And to his credit, he, in the 90s, seems to have really tried to reconstruct the superhero and say, okay, look, we've all broken it down now, but let's put it back together, okay? And
so
he tried really hard, but it doesn't seem like it really worked, unfortunately. People seem still more interested in deconstruction than in reconstruction.
Well, I think you're right, but I mean, I think the main reason for that is that our readership our readership has been reading comics for too long. I mean, it's hard, you know. How do you make this stuff interesting when you know it? You've seen the tropes done so often, and it's kind of been one of the things to kind of link it back to an earlier topic. One of the things that I'm really hopeful about the whole Disney thing is that that will help us get an influx of younger readers again, to whom all this stuff is new, because this stuff is naturally, you know, it's superhero soap opera. It's naturally very cyclical. And when it's the same people reading it for 20, 30 years, I'm not absolutely sure that it's a genre that's best suited for that level of scrutiny, frankly. You know,
to go back to Eric Larson for 1 second, if you'll allow me.
Eric Larson.
I know. But he always liked to say, when people would talk about that, about, you know, I want Spider-Man to do this now because it doesn't make sense. It's too childish. He always would say, well, look, you don't, when you start watching Scooby-Doo for so long that you're wondering why he doesn't hump everybody's leg, you stop watching Scooby-Doo. Like, they're not going to age Scooby-Doo for you. Like, it's still going to be there for the kids.
Right.
And to some extent, I think, yeah, comic books have started humping people's legs because we've aged them.
Well, at least people in comics, one or the other. No, it's sure. It's a horrible metaphor for an absolutely valid point that yeah, it's an issue, and that's not to say that I don't think clearly from the work that I do, I think is just specifically the work that I'm interested in illustrating.
Right.
I'm interested in illustrating work that's geared more towards an older, you know, I dare I say more sophisticated reader, just for just someone from just who's. Well read
kind of
and a little bit older,
because I know your wife is actually a does work for
children's books.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that's sort of that odd kind of a comparison, really.
Right. It's what I'm really saying is that the children's stuff should be for geared for children, and then there'll be other stuff that's geared for adults. And I don't know how valuable it is to mix the two up. If that makes sense.
Yeah, we have two more questions, actually.
We just got two more to wrap up on.
Okay.
If that's cool with you guys.
Absolutely cool. Great with me.
Sure.
All right. The Mild Mannered Podcast is geared mostly towards trade editions, graphic novels, hardcovers. And for a part of the comic reading audience that Gail Simone has been calling trade waiters, and the people who don't have a monthly pull list, go out and buy the individual issues, but instead wait for collected edition, any maybe one shots or graphic novels. From the industry perspective, how do you guys feel about how that affects sales and the industry as a whole?
I'll let Jordan answer that first.
Okay. You know, it's that's tough. It is one of those kind of, you know, always paradox things that if you like a book enough, it's just there are people who don't want to buy things till they come on trades, as you said, you guys, for example. There's always going to be that risk that the comic's not going to sell well enough and it's going to get canceled. I mean, okay, here's an example. The book Exiles that I just worked on, the last issue just came out, issue 6. It just, you know, it didn't do very well, unfortunately, and it got canceled. I think it's a great book, and I think that there's an audience out there for it. So you can there's all sorts of reasons why you could say it didn't do well. I'm not saying it's because people were waiting for the trade, but the reason I bring it up is when you guys read it in the trade, you guys might love it, and it doesn't matter. There's still not going to be any more. Certain companies do it different ways. Obviously, Vertigo, if you look at the way they seem to operate, again, I don't have any inside information on Vertigo, but the way they seem to operate is they don't tend to cancel things until issue like 12 or so at least, so that they can see how the trades do first. Marvel tends to be a lot more immediate based on the sales like that. And they do. I know they figure in things like how they think the trades are going to do.
So they do figure that. Okay, I wasn't sure if they ever actually kind of took account of
that. Sure. I mean, the people looking at the numbers, they're not naive. They know that trades exist, you know. It's just, but at the same time, if a book can't support itself for 6 months, they're not going to say, well, we'll just wait for the trade. They're going to say, it's not supporting itself for 6 months. We're going to have to end it. We'll do the one trade, and that's it.
Hmm.
And then you know, there's always the possibility. I mean, again, they're not foolish, so they know if things do well. If all of a sudden everybody on the internet goes out and buys the trade of Exile, they'll go, huh, maybe there was more in it than we thought. It doesn't seem to go that way, usually, that things sell insanely better in trade. When it does, then those things will continue, you know. I'm pretty sure, like, Runaways tends to do better in trades. I don't know for sure. I think it does better in trades than it does than your average book. And I think that's one of the reasons they keep doing more of it.
Point taken.
Yeah.
I mean, look, what I think it comes down to is that, you know, if you're an umbrella salesman and it stops raining, you can't complain that you can't sell umbrellas anymore. You have to adapt, you know? If this behavior continues, the history of of telling your market what they need to do does not have a great history. It's very rare that you can tell people, listen, you need to buy CDs instead of this. You need to buy this instead of that. Or you need to stop downloading. You need to stop doing this. You can't really change people's behavior that way, So as a business person, you got to do the harder thing, which is to try to anticipate what behavior is and try to figure out how to make money off of it. This is a behavior that people are exhibiting. This is the way if people end up wanting to buy trades more than floppies or monthly books or whatever, then it behooves the people in business to figure out how to make money on that model, And if not, they won't be in business, I got to believe that if enough people want to buy trades, someone will come out there going, hey, people want to buy trades. Let's make trades and we'll sell it to them. And things will be fantastic. That's the way business works. That's the way business always works. And companies come and go for that reason. And that's just the way that it goes. Not to take anything away from Gail about the topic. It just seems to me that it's very, very difficult to tell people, this is how you have to spend your money. I mean, if I like trades, that's my business. And if you want to have them for me to buy, great. And if you don't, then I won't buy them. That's it. Mm-hmm. I'm the customer. I got the money. You want my money, but you do what I say. That's all there is to it.
That's absolutely true. I will say, speaking as an individual and speculationist, rather than a Marvel employee.
Of course, yeah.
I kind of think that trades are sort of going to – I don't think trades are going to become the main thing. Because mostly because I think – I do feel like it was going that way for a while, but now that the possibility of electronic comic books seems to be rising up more and more.
Was it Marvel? Was Marvel one of the companies that just recently made a deal with Iverse Media to actually sell some of their comics via that application on the iPhone?
I think Marvel. I could be wrong. I think Marvel's doing their own thing. That issue. I think it was another company that went with another major company that went with Iverse.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I hope Marvel does do something for the iPhone though. That I would pick that up and as well.
I mean, that's the thing. There are so many things coming up. There's the iPhone stuff. There's the what is that company? Longbox. What?
Longbox. That's what it was called, I think. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that could be it. Yeah, yeah. Longbox.
There's this Longbox thing for computers. There's when they have the color readers like Kindles, that'll change the market again. And I feel like if anything is going to take away dominance from the monthly pamphlet, whatever you want to call it, comic, it would probably be that first.
Although, again, to make the opposite argument, just, to make it interesting, just for fun, if as I believe, the future health of our industry is tied into getting younger readers, that's probably we're going to probably see a I'm going to predict that if we see an influx of younger readers, we're going to go back to a primarily a monthly pamphlet based or small digest based kind of printable business, because most parents still aren't comfortable with their 4 to 8 year old walking around with a Kindle or some other sort of very expensive electronic device. I'm serious. I mean, they'd rather just give them a book, and that's not this. And I say that. Sounds facetious. I'm not really being facetious, because that may also change. When the 17-year-olds or the 14-year-olds are 30 and have their own kids, and they've been walking around with Kindles and iPhones their entire life, and someone comes out like a Ribbit or someone like that comes out with a book, a kid's book reader, and Marvel sells comics through a kid's book reader, that's probably going to work better than anything. So yeah, who's to know? Yeah. But I was just saying, for right now, I think if we get that influx of the kids market, I think we're going to see a resurgence of cheaply printed material again. Not trades, but monthly pamphlets or digests. That's my official prediction. There you go.
Official.
Enjoy.
Mine was unofficial.
His was unofficial. Mine's official.
Jordan's off the record.
I'm very much on the record. I'm spitting on the record.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
So Now that we've had we've had a fantastic hour and a half discussion.
Yeah,
now.
This has been great. What a, for a 20th episode, this is going to be great.
Of the really, really great, really cerebral discussion of all things comics. Thank you guys so much. We'd like to end with just something lighthearted. For our friend Michael John Gilbert,
who's
having severe technical difficulties and wanted to ask one last question.
As we like to refer to it, the void ever...
The void comes.
That's for you, Jordan.
Thank you.
And so, for both of you guys, right now, don't think about it. This is from Mike. Without thinking, who's your favorite comic book character? Go.
Go, Jordan.
It's got to be Spider-Man. That's such a cheesy thing to say, but he's Spider-Man, man. He's awesome.
I love Spider-Man. Dennis?
Wow, man. Batman.
All right.
I just closed my eyes and just said it. Batman. Spider-Man's a very, very close second, Well, God damn it. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I think, okay, look. To read Spider-Man. I think my favorite character to draw would probably be Batman, but I haven't drawn him professionally yet, so I don't know.
Is Spider-Man a pain in the ass because of all the webs?
No, it's fun. Actually, the webs cover up a lot of crappy anatomy, so it actually works out well. Those guys knew what they were doing. They designed those costumes. Man, by and large, they knew what they were doing. That's good stuff over there. To read, probably Spider-Man. And I would be Jordan. Make a note. I would love to draw a Spider-Man story. That'd be fantastic.
All right.
I would read that. I would love to see you do Batman. Actually,
they're gonna say Spider-Man. Okay.
I'd love to see both. You know, I'm not sure. Have you tried out Arkham Asylum yet, Dennis?
Oh, the video game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played with it. It's very different from the graphic novel. I'll say that.
Obviously, yeah.
Not the same experience. I've played with the demo so far. It's fun. I don't know if I'm going to buy it yet, but I'm not a big video gamer in general. I love video games that are just very time consuming. So I stay away from it. But I do have a PS3 and I love it for the media. I mean, I would recommend a PS3. That's another official recommendation. I love PS3.
Yeah. Blu-ray. Now that the Slim came out, I'm tempted to actually pick one up eventually.
Oh, dude, Blu-ray and all the audio codecs, and it syncs wirelessly with all your media servers and your computers. So it's lovely. It's a lovely piece of equipment. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
That's pretty cool. I bought myself a PlayStation 2 when I got the job at Marvel to celebrate.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty far behind on the.
Jordan is slowly playing his way up through everything.
He's got an Atari 2600.
Yeah.
It's very.
Yeah. That was when he got to college.
Combat's a great game. It's awesome.
Burger time, yo.
Burger time, yo. There you go.
Again, thanks so much to both of you. Oh, God, this has been fantastic.
We've been talking to Dennis Calero and White. Guys,
Or George D. White and Dennis Calero.
That's
it. We went alphabetical. It's all good.
Yeah. Oh, okay, that's it. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
Sure, okay, we'll just say that.
Guys, thanks so much for coming out.
Thank you for having us.
You guys take care.
Guests. Bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
He was a famous star, but never more Chicago way. He had a movie star that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. Guitar is with him, and the company jumps and he was ready.
Boogie, boogie, boogie.